Pastor Jay said I'd hug anyone. I think I'll put a qualifier on that. If you don't bring a casserole, I'll hug you. Here's the question. What will it really take for you to live your life like God is the owner? Now, be sure you understand, I'm not asking you if God is the owner of your life. I already know He is. But I also know there was a time in my life, even when God was the owner, I was living like I was the owner. There was a time in my life when I'd do good things, things that others might even call godly, yet if the truth be known, I was the owner, and I was still calling the shots. And I also know I'm not the only one who has lived that way. So my question is, what will it take for you and me to really live like God is the owner? Maybe you've heard or read of that moment when Tony Campolo tells of the decision he made to live like God was really the owner of his life. You understand, he was already a Christian. In fact, he was a preacher of the gospel. He was already involved in kingdom building. And yet, there came a point, an event in his life that he had to admit that while he was doing all these good things, he was still calling the shots. And he was still the one who was making the decisions on what he would do and how often he would do it and how he would do it and who he would do it for and what it would cost him. This is how he told of that moment. He said, I was outside the border of the Dominican Republic in northern Haiti. I was standing on a grassy landing strip waiting for a small airplane to pick me up and take me back to the capital city. As I searched the skies looking for the airplane, a woman came towards me. In her arms, she was holding a baby with its stomach swelled 4 or 5 times the normal size. This happens when children are experiencing malnutrition and has a serious case of worms. The arms and the legs of the child were skin and bones and hung limply from his body. It was a black child, but its hair was rust-colored, also a sign of advanced malnutrition. The child was one of the most sickening and upsetting cases I've ever seen. The mother held her child up to me and begged me to take the child to the United States. Her hope was that I would cure her little child and raise him as my own. I tried to get away from her, he said, but she wouldn't let me go. In a most pathetic manner, she begged, please, mister, take my baby. Take my baby. Don't let my baby die. Don't let my baby die. Please, mister, take my baby. She kept pleading with me over and over again, and I kept trying to get away from her. I didn't know what to do. There were hundreds of babies within 5 miles of where I was standing with problems so immense that I was confused and upset, but she kept begging me, save my baby. Don't let my baby die. Don't let my baby die. Please, please. Finally, the small airplane I'd been waiting for came into sight, and as soon as it touched the landing strip, I ran across the field to meet it. She came running after me, screaming at the top of her lungs, don't let my baby die. I climbed into the plane as fast as I could and closed the plexiglass door. The engines began to rev up, but before the plane began rolling, she caught up to her, holding her baby in one hand. She banged on the fuselage with the other. The roar of the engines drowned out her voice, but I could see her lips still moving as she still screamed at me to take her baby. Then the plane pulled away from her, down the landing strip and into the air. And as we circled the field, I saw her standing alone on the grassy landing strip. It wasn't long before I realized who I had left behind. It wasn't just a dying Haitian child. I knew I had left Jesus behind. And then he said, I fear that one day the Lord will say, I was hungry and you didn't feed me, naked and you didn't clothe me, sick and you didn't care for me, a stranger and you didn't take me in. And I'll say, Lord, when did I see you hungry and not feed you, naked and not clothe you, sick and not minister to you, a stranger and not take you in? And he will say to me, when you failed to do it for that baby, you failed to do it for me. And from that very moment on, Tony Campolo said he began to live his life like God was really the owner of his life. He said, since that time, I've become intensely aware that every person must be treated as Jesus. Every human being, no matter how hungry or how nasty, is a vehicle through whom I can love my resurrected Lord. And so he did something about it. He began an orphanage there in Haiti and has a network of 85 schools that serve children of Haiti, one of the poorest nations in the world. Because Jesus is now the owner, he and a group of college students each bought one stock of share in the largest multinational company in the Dominican Republic. That company just dominates the economy over there. That one share stock gave them the right to attend stockholders meeting. And they went and they raised the question why the company wasn't doing more to help the people. And the executives of that company changed their practices and began to invest in the education and the medical services and spent over $500 million to help improve the lives of those who lived in that region. All because there were these students who began to live like God was really the owner of their lives. Because Jesus is now the owner of his life and his time and his checkbook. He also helped to start an urban missionary program and educational program in Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey. You see, when you and I really began to live like God is the owner, we become aware of every opportunity. And no opportunity is too crazy or too risky. And no opportunity costs too much to try. But the question remains, what will it really take? What will it take for you and me to really live like God is the owner? For Paul, it was getting knocked off the donkey and onto his fanny and blinded by the light of Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus when he was going there to have Christians arrested. For Lydia in the Bible, it was just having someone explain to her who Jesus was and what it meant to live like he was the owner. For that small group of believers in the city of Ephesus, it too was having Paul show up and explain to them who the Holy Spirit was. They had never even heard of him and how they needed to be filled with his very presence and then live like he was the owner. For my dad, it was my bigger sister simply asking him, why don't we go to church like Aunt Alice? And so he took us to church, heard one sermon, and that night knelt beside the side of his bed and asked Christ to come into his life, and he was radically and forever transformed. For me, it was when I finally said yes to God's call to be a pastor, after trying to outmaneuver God for years, and when I said yes, that really settled who was the owner of my life. It didn't settle who was the owner of my life. He was the owner of my life, but I started living like it. You see, there's no prescribed way or time or event, but the question remains the same for each one of us on a very personal level. What will it take for you to really live your life like God is the owner of your life? As you know, we've been looking at what Jesus said is the most important life principles we need to allow to guide our life. And maybe today's sermon, looking at Jesus' parable that we're going to look at, should have been the very first sermon preached rather than the last one preached on this subject. Maybe we should have started here, but we started by looking at what Jesus said is the most important life principle, and that's when he said the most important thing is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He said, that's the big deal. This is it. Get this right first. But then he immediately said the second most important life principle is just like the first. We have to love others. He said, that too is a big deal. And we took that step principle even a step further by realizing to really love our neighbor, to really love others, we have to actively, purposely encourage others. Well, remember what Paul said? Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up. And then last week we looked at what it really means to serve our world. And we saw it's crucial to realize our world is simply one person, and then another person, and then another. Don't make it too big. Don't make it too difficult. Serve your world by serving one person, and then another, and then another. And so we look first at the challenge. To serve our world means we have to realize this isn't an option for us as Christ followers. This has to be part of our spiritual DNA. This has to be part of who we are. And we saw what's really critical if we're going to put this into practice. It starts with our attitude. We can't judge who is worthy or unworthy or who is deserving of us reaching out and helping. If we do that with a stinking thinking attitude, the one who serves, you can't do that. We have to be willing to serve whoever we encounter. And then and only then can we take the right actions that will make a difference, because we're doing it with the right heart. And then we looked at the right choice, or the choice we need to make. The choice is never should I serve, but how do I serve? And we looked at a number of ways that the church provides with us for opportunities to serve our world. You know, Pastor Jay talked about those service projects coming up next weekend. Can still sign up. We're going to be taking a Thanksgiving offering so that the gospel of Jesus can be heard around the world, and providing a Thanksgiving meal for families that are in need here in Springfield. And all of those things are important, and more. All of those things are part of what it means to serve our world. But we must make sure we don't make that principle of serving our world so broad, so big, that we miss it, making it personal. You and I, we are to serve our world, and the world we are to serve are those people who come across our path. It's those people we have called our interruptions. But you know what we haven't talked about yet? We haven't really talked about what it's going to cost. I mean, we talked about a lot of things that's going to cost you and me. We talked about a Thanksgiving offering and buying bread for St. John's Breadline and buying Thanksgiving meals for others. All of that costs money. But in an even more specific way, we need to talk about what it will cost for you and me to really live out this life principle, all of them that Jesus says are the most important, and what it'll cost for you and me to realize Jesus is saying to you and me, this is it. This is the big deal. You got to get this part right. What's it going to cost for you and me to really live like God is the owner of our life? In fact, Jesus is the one who said, you need to count the cost. He said, if you're going to build a building, you need to count the cost before you start. He said, if you're going to go to war, you need to count the cost to see if you can win it. And if you're going to be my follower, he said, you need to count the cost. And I'm sure you've heard some churches say you need to tithe. You need to give 10% of your income to God, and you need to support the building fund and the support missions, and you need to give this off to this offering and that offering. Well, I'm not going to tell you you need to tithe 10%. And give to the building fund or missions and all the rest. I'm going to tell you what Jesus said. He said, it's going to cost you everything you have. How do you like that? He said, in the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Really let that sink in. Jesus said, in the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has, he cannot be my disciple. And that statement has everything to do with living like Jesus is the owner of our lives. It has everything to do not with us deciding what we're going to do and what we're going to give and how we're going to spend our time and who we're going to try to reach, but rather doing exactly what the owner tells us to do. There's a parable that Jesus told one day that I want us to look at. And it's all about making the disciples who he was telling the parable to answer this very question. Are you living your life like God is the owner of your life? Jesus told this parable to the disciples on the Tuesday of the week when he was going to be crucified on Friday. On Sunday, he had entered into Jerusalem and was treated like a king. On Friday, he would be beaten beyond recognition and finally crucified and then laid in a borrowed tomb. But on Tuesday of that week, Jesus is one more time trying to prepare the disciples for what is going to happen in just a matter of days and prepare them for the hurricane of emotions that is just about ready to explode in their lives. And the amazing thing to me is he didn't tell them to go run and hide or come up with an escape plan. Or even hold a prayer meeting begging God that he would make it possible for them to avoid the storm that was coming. But instead he said to them, keep living like I'm the owner. That's the purpose of your life. That's why you're here. When the storm threatens to rock your world, when the challenges are great, when you're tempted to run away as fast as you can, just keep living like I'm the owner of your life. So I want you to take your Bibles and turn over to the Gospel of Matthew, the 25th chapter. We're going to start reading in the 14th verse, Matthew 25, and keep your Bibles open because we're going to keep going back to the parable. We're not going to read all of it right now, but let's start in verse 14. It says, again, It'll be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. You can continue reading that as I preach along. You can do those 2 things at the same time. But let's stop right there. I want us to look first again at the challenge. That's letter A in your notes, the challenge. It's obvious from the parable that the challenge isn't deciding who is the owner, but rather, are you and I living like God is the owner of our life? The challenge isn't who do you say is the owner of your life, but are you living like God is the owner of your life? You see, we know some of the disciples who were listening to that parable had never, ever settled the ownership question. Judas was there. He definitely was not living like Jesus was the owner. In a matter of days, he would sell Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver. You don't do that when Jesus is the owner. And James and John and the others were there. The others that were there, they are going to start arguing about who is the greatest disciple. So while they would have claimed that God was the owner, the truth is they weren't living like God was the owner of their life. So the big deal was answering this question. Are you really living like God is the owner of your life? Now, in the parable, both the 5-talent guy and the 2-talent guy had evidently long settled that question. They understood what it meant to live like the owner was the owner. But the 1-talent guy that we're told about never settled that question. So let's look first at the excuses the 1-talent guy used. Understand, he would have claimed loud and long he was living like the owner was the owner. But his life, his actions, his decisions said something else. First, the 1-talent guy blamed the owner. Verse 24, Master, he said, I knew you were a hard man, harvesting where you had not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. The other two didn't say anything like that. That's not a good description of the owner. He was saying, it's your fault. Not mine. I didn't do what you told me to do, and it's your fault. And the owner saw right through that excuse. Here he was, just giving thousands and thousands of dollars. That's what talents were. It's money back then. Of his own money, and saying to these 3 guys, invest it. Take the risk. And this 1-talent guy was pointing his accusing finger back at the owner and saying, it's your fault. It's your fault that I didn't do what you asked. Next, he blamed the obstacles. Each servant, no matter how much they were given, faced the exact same obstacles in life, but the 1-talent guy tried to use the obstacles as an excuse for not doing what the owner told him to do. If we're going to live like God is the owner, we need to learn not to blame the obstacles that are in our life for not doing what God has told us to do. Every person who has ever lived on this little green earth has faced obstacles when it came to obeying God. And those who succeed are the ones who overcome the obstacles in life. You can use them as stepping stones or stumbling stones. You can use them as an excuse why you couldn't, or use them to explain how you did it in spite of the obstacles. Satan is a very real enemy. How did Peter put it? Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. And so, of course, he's going to put obstacles in your path and in my path. And he will tell us daily, maybe minute by minute, you can't do what God has told you to do. He'll tell you God's way won't work. He'll tell you you're a fool if you do what God says, like forgive or go the second mile or turn the other cheek or give or get involved in ministry or try again or give him a second chance. He'll tell you, you don't have time for that. You're busy enough, and you don't have to start an orphanage in Haiti. You can't afford it. He'll tell you, you are the owner of your life, and you can do whatever you want. But understand, on that day when the owner returns, whatever obstacles we've had in our life won't matter, because the owner has already given us everything we need to succeed. He has given us resources and instructions, and he's told us what to expect, and he has said to us, take the risk. It's worth it. Take the risk. So if you're not living like God is the owner, don't fall into the trap of blaming the obstacles. You see, that was the problem of the 1-talent guy. He never settled the ownership question or the responsibility question. And folks, if we haven't settled those two things in our life, then nothing else we are told in this parable even matters. Are you really living like God is the owner? Are you accepting responsibility for your own actions and your own decisions? Well, let's look at the five-talent guy and the two-talent guy and see what it means to really live like God is the owner, because that should be our goal. So let's look at Jesus' explanation. It begins by realizing he has entrusted you and me with his property. It's his property. Verse 14 says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. And the five-talent guy and the two-talent guy understood it was the owner's money and lived like it. They understood it wasn't their money. They understood they had a responsibility to be a steward of what had been given to them, and they were to use and manage what they had been given. And because they understood who the owner was, there was no squabbling over the fact that one was given more than the other. There's no jealousy. There's no complaining. There's no whining. You gave him more than you gave me. There was none of that, because they realized they weren't the owners. It wasn't their money. It was the owner's money. Secondly, they followed the owner's explanation, his instructions. You see, that Greek word translated entrusted doesn't mean he simply gave it to them and said, do with it what you want. It means he gave it to them and then explained in great detail exactly what they were to do with the money. He gave them detailed instructions. And I have no doubt he said something like, I want you to take the risk. I want you to understand, even if you lose everything, it's okay as long as you've done what I've instructed. So they followed his instructions about his money, his explanation. That's part of living like the owner is the owner. And then number three, they knew what the owner expected. They knew that one day they would have to give an accounting of what they had done with what they had been given. They knew that one day this journey the owner was on would be over, he would come home, and he wouldn't say, how much money have you made me? But rather would say, did you follow my instructions? What did you do with what I gave you? So they knew exactly what it was the owner expected of them. Okay, let's get this to where you and I are living. You see, the problem is for many, for all the talk we talk and all the songs we sing and all the good things we do, many of us do not really recognize God as the owner of everything we have in our lives. And we are the ones who are still calling the shots at times. What about your marriage and family? Why, that's your marriage and family, isn't it? You can do what you want. Or is it God's? He has given it to you to take care of. You understand, your marriage and family is something instituted by God, created by God. Are you acting like you're the owner so you can treat your spouse and your family however you want? You can threaten divorce. You can walk out. You can scream. You can slam doors because you're the owner. Or are you living like God is the owner and you're following his instructions when it comes to relationships? What about your finances? Let's say between you and your spouse, if you have a spouse, you earn $1,000 this week. How much of that belongs to God? Now, if you said, we made $1,000, so $100 belongs to God, that's 10%, that's a tithe, then somehow I didn't do the job I need to be doing as your pastor over these last 15 years. Because you see, if you made $1,000 last week, $1,000 belongs to God. And he's concerned not only with what you give back to him, but also what you do with the rest of the resources he has entrusted to you. What about your time? What about your talents and gifts and abilities? What about your job? Do you do your job like God is the owner that you're really working for? You see, this is really a critical question that we need to answer. Because if we're living like we are the owner, then we can do whatever we want. And it doesn't matter what God has instructed and what he expects, because we think we're the owner. And you see, that's exactly what the one talent guy was coming from in this parable. He really thought of himself as the owner. He thought he had the right to do whatever he wanted with what had been given to him. He could ignore the instructions. He could ignore what was expected. He could do his own thing. If he wanted to bury the money, he could bury it. If he didn't want to risk it, he didn't have to, even though the owner had instructed him, take the risk. And you see, I really am persuaded this is the core issue for so many people. Who are you really living like is the owner of your life? Who is the owner of your possessions? Who is the owner of your marriage and family and job and your time and your talent and all those other relationships you have? We see all of that brings us, of course, to the critical. That's the letter B in your notes, the critical. It's really another question we need to ask and answer of ourselves. Here's the question. What are you doing with what you've been given? And this is really the part we need to listen to, especially if you ever happen to have felt like the one talent guy. Because God isn't going to ask you, have you won the world? He's not going to ask you if you've done as much as this guy over here or that guy over there. The owner of the parable didn't ask the one talent guy if he had done as well as the two talent guy. And he didn't ask the two talent guy if he had done as much as the five talent guy. But he did ask them all the same question. What did you do with what you were given? And you understand, that's the question one day I'll have to answer, and you'll have to answer. God's not going to ask me, Fred, how many sermons did you preach? Or how many Bible studies did you lead? Or how many board meetings did you lead? He's going to ask me, Fred, what have you done with the grace I have given to you? And the life I've given to you? And the marriage and family I've given to you? And the ministry I've given to you? And the people I've put into your life? And he will hold me accountable. And he won't ask you, listen carefully, he won't ask you how often you came to church and how much money you gave and if you taught Sunday school and did you participate in service projects and did you buy a Thanksgiving meal for someone in need and did you sing on the worship team. But he will ask you, what did you do with what you were given? Did you really live like he was the owner? Did you follow his instructions? Did you obey his word? The question will be exactly the same if you're five talent, two talent, or one talent person. What did you do with what you were given? That's the whole point of the parable. Jesus told this entire parable to the disciples on that Tuesday so that the disciples would answer one question. And he inspired Matthew to include this parable when he was writing his account of Jesus' life just so you and me could answer the question. And he inspired Luke to also include this in his gospel account, just so you and I could answer that same question. What are you doing with what you've been given? Are you holding back? Are you saying, Lord, I'll give you this and that, and Lord, I'll do whatever you ask except that over there. I'm still the owner over there. I still want to call the shots when it comes to my marriage or that other relationship or my career or being involved in ministry. I can still call the shots on how much I give. I can still call the shots on what I put on my calendar. Or, Lord, you just don't know what's going on in my life. I'm so busy right now, so I can't do anymore. It's such a simplistic question. What are you doing with what you've been given? Are you investing yourself in something of eternal value? Are you really living like God is the owner? Now we're to letter C in your notes, the choice. And the question is, what will you do? What will you and I do with what Jesus has just said? Making excuses why we are not obeying God, that won't cut it. Just ignoring it like we didn't know, what will you and I do? Jesus gave two different promises that should affect our choice. The first is a negative promise. We don't like this. Jesus is very blunt. If you're not living like God is the owner, if you don't use what you've been given for something of great eternal value, Jesus says, what you were given will be taken away. And then he says, on that day when you have to give an account, he said, you're out of here. Verse 30, throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We don't like that. You understand, by the choices we make, we alone are deciding to live outside the grace and the blessing of God or not. We alone are putting ourselves in a position where we will either see God work or not see him work. We're putting ourselves in a position where we won't know the joy of answered prayer and being surprised by the grace of Jesus. How did Jesus put it in the parable? You won't share in your master's happiness. It's a promise. It's negative. We don't like it. But it's a promise of judgment. Understand, it is impossible for God to lie. His promises are true, even the negative ones. But there's a second promise in this parable also, and it's a positive promise. This is amazing, and this is what we really need to grab a hold of. When you and I risk everything and begin to invest ourselves in something of eternal value, we lose absolutely nothing. When we live our faith, live our life by faith and live like God is the owner, we lose nothing. When we begin to handle our marriage the way God says and we don't seek the divorce but choose to work through the difficulties, when we begin to respond in Christ-like ways in all of our relationships, we lose absolutely nothing. When we handle conflicts and we disagree with someone but we do it in a Christ-like way, when we begin to handle our finances the way God dictates, when we choose to be ethical, when we choose to not tear down another person, but rather love them and encourage them no matter how they act, we lose absolutely nothing. In fact, we gain everything. We will finally really experience the joy and the contentment and the peace that we have so longed for. I just love how Jesus put it. He said, come and share in your master's happiness. And then he promised, for everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. He is promising you and me an abundance in our life, an abundance of his grace and his contentment and his happiness and his joy and his peace. Folks, that's the promise God has made to those who are willing to invest themselves in something of great eternal value and to live like God is the owner of everything in our life. He didn't say we're not going to have tough times. He didn't promise no heartaches. He was telling this first to a group of 12 guys who are about to face the worst storm of their life in just a matter of hours. And he wasn't going to say, and he wasn't saying it's going to go away. But now he's promising us, if we're willing to live like God is the owner, even in tough times, especially in tough times, he says, I will bless you with an abundance. So let me ask that question again. What are you really doing with what you've been given? In just a moment, I want us to celebrate what we've been given, what has been entrusted to us by the owner. I want us to celebrate the grace we've received. I want us to do that by receiving communion together. But before we take those elements that represent the body and blood of our Savior, I want each one of us to take a moment and ask ourselves, what am I really doing with the grace God has entrusted to me? Am I living like he is the owner? Am I extending grace to those that really need it and that I've received? And then I want us to sing that song, Grace on Top of Grace, just to remind ourselves what we've received, and then we'll receive communion together. But bow your heads with me right now.